I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this September 8. The Endangered Political Historian was the subject of an op-ed piece in the New York Times on August 29, and we thought it would be an interesting discussion. The American historical profession, the article goes, has to a large extent abdicated its responsibility to educate students in the political history of the nation. Political historians have become something of an endangered species on our campus with ramifications that extend well beyond the academy. The public need and appetite for political history remains strong, but our higher education institutions still don't get it. The co-author of the piece is with us this hour, Kenneth Osgood. He's a professor of history and director of the Honors Program in Public Affairs at the Colorado School of Mines, which is a leading applied science and engineering university. His research interests, the history of propaganda and intelligence, the history of media, advertising, and public relations, and U.S. political and diplomatic history. He's the author or editor of five books, including Total Cold War, Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda, A Battle at Home and Abroad, The Cold War After Stalin's Death, A Missed Opportunity for Peace, and many other books. And he is currently writing a book about the connections between the advertising industry and the CIA in the 1950s and 60s. It focuses on a decades-long campaign called the Crusade for Freedom, and we'll hear a little bit about that during the course of the hour as well. Well, welcome phone calls, and here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Kenneth Osgood, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I'm not in Milwaukee, but I do get to listen to your show via podcast, and I've enjoyed it.
You do.
I'm calling from another beer producing town of Golden, Colorado.
How is it out in Colorado today?
Gorgeous as always. It may appear to always snow on Monday Night Football, but out here it's usually pretty sunny and nice.
Yeah. Well, it's a great honor to have you with us this hour. Why don't we start by talking about what a definition of political history is? Is it campaigns? Is it political rhetoric? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, so that's a great question. So just as a sort of backdrop for the listeners, historians, especially at higher education, we develop specializations. And those specializations, you know, have a great influence on what we research and what we teach. You know, you have social historians who study social movements, you have cultural historians who study culture, economic historians, and so on. And political history is, you know, typically the study of the political process, things such as elections and elected officials, policy and policy making, parties and party politics, and in some ways how one thinks about the study of political history determines what you see. And what we articulated in our op-ed piece is that the study of these kind of core political topics and how they've shaped our institutions of government, our democratic evolution, have been on the decline. And as a result, our sort of reservoir of expertise, the training we give to undergraduate students and teachers and the like, is not reflecting the level of sort of expertise that we need to develop and inform citizenry.
Mm-hmm. And you also say that this will translate into limited or non-existent undergraduate courses, and then it will go down the line, right? So if you don't have people studying this and able to teach it who have taken courses in college, they're not going to be able to do it in high school or in middle school either.
Yeah, and one of the key lost opportunities is that in college is that moment where as a young student, your sort of the wisdom you've inherited gets challenged and gets complicated and it gets messy, and you begin to understand that you know, the universe that you were formed in is often shaped by your products of your school, by your parents, by your family structure, your community. And it's in college where you begin to see that actually the world's a lot more complicated than that. It's a lot more messy. And that's really important for how we educate the next generation so they understand that politics is not simply a morality play of black and white, of good versus evil, but it's a messy process. It involves compromise, difficult choices, and it's not a zero-sum game. And what we have happening is that lack of sort of sophisticated understanding of the messiness of the political process is translated into how we see our younger students being educated as well. So as politics disappears from higher education, so it begins to fade away, at least in a sophisticated way, from the curriculum at the lower levels of the educational system.
Kenneth, you write, knowledge of our political past is important because it can serve as an antidote to the misuse of history by our leaders. Give us some examples. How has it been misused, our lack of political history awareness?
Well, one of my favorite but perhaps most notorious examples, and this is actually something that my co-author, Fred Logavall, and I wrote about a few years ago as well, is the Munich analogy. And if it hasn't come up, actually it has come up a lot already this election, and in fact you can pretty much predict that any election cycle, the bugaboo of appeasement in Munich will hang a given political candidate or another, or be used in that way. And basically this is a classic example alluding back to the eve of the Second World War, when Neville Chamberlain meets with Adolf Hitler. They come to an agreement. He says, I've averted war, I've appeased him, and all is going to be fine. And then, of course, a matter of days, basically, the Nazis invade Poland and World War II is upon us. And so ever since then, appeasement has been the ultimate dirty word in American politics. And so what it means is that any time a sitting president, especially, or a prominent political leader connected to international affairs, reaches out to someone that's viewed as an adversary or a threat, and engages in negotiations, those negotiations are immediately cast into doubt as being Neville Chamber-like, ignorant appeasement. And this example has had a powerful impact over the course of the almost a century since the word first appeared, in that any moment of sort of attempted compromise imposes a political risk. So John F. Kennedy, on the eve of the Cuban Missile Crisis, is deeply aware of the fact that his father, Joseph Kennedy, had been sort of a tied or sort of connected to the idea of appeasement. So he's very worried about looking weak. Lyndon Johnson, on the eve of the Vietnam War, similar thing. He's worried that he's vulnerable to charges of appeasement, and so he needs to look tough. We saw this with Barack Obama reaching out to Iran and reaching the nuclear deal, accused of appeasement and this type of thing. And we're going to see it again with Hillary Clinton in this election. For one thing or another, will be called an appeaser, and the old Munich analogy will be used. And it really means nothing, but it has powerful resonance.
And yet we've lived through times when we've been able to see, people have been able to see the other side, right? So we may, John Kennedy may have worried about that, and yet he was able to get together generals and people who had different points of view to navigate the Cuban Missile Crisis. LBJ was able to get through incredible civil rights legislation, getting some Southerners to be able to agree to this through his political persuasion. Some have said that those eras, we kind of long for them now, because now we've reached a point where nobody wants to stick his or her neck out on anything because they're going to lose their vote. They're going to lose their place in Congress.
Yes, I mean, we've definitely, I mean, American history, we often sort of hear pundits in the political universe now saying, America's never been more divided. Well, yeah, it has. It certainly was in 1860. But what has happened is that within the halls of Congress, the idea of compromise is a dirty word. Mm-hmm. I suppose it's very similar to the appeasement analogy, right? It almost plays out in terms of how legislation is made. If you make a deal with the devil, you are compromised. I mean, even the simple thing of Governor Christie, greeting Barack Obama and thanking him for the hurricane relief funds, he was pilloried by the right side of his party. And so this notion that we can make tough choices and tough bargains to get hard things done is increasingly vanishing from our understanding of the political process.
You know where I really notice it, Kenneth, when we're in the middle of a presidential campaign and we get very little reference on the part of any commentators. Cable news shows just have talking heads who are talking about what happened today or yesterday. We get very little historical reference. And I think a lot of people are hungry for that and would find it very interesting to know about political comparisons, this election compared to whenever, appeasement now compared to whenever. There are so many parts of history that would better inform us as we carry on.
Yeah, one of the points we also make is that the study of history can help us better understand the effects of our actions. Mm-hmm. You know, you get some sense of what happens. We can also understand that in other times, as we say, of division and challenge, when the country faced great difficulties, how did people respond? Well, they responded sometimes by rising to the challenge, sometimes by reaching out to the other side, by building unity. We should be cautious not to idealize the past at the same time. There have been, partisanship is an integral part of what it means to have a democracy in the United States. Even you think about the Second World War, we have this image of the time as being one where we all came together, but it was incredibly contentious politically. FDR faced all kinds of challenges. So the notion that sort of domestic politics stopped when the country went to war, of course, is fallacious. But there is something to be learned, I guess, is my bottom line on that point.
Mm-hmm. So you ask the question, and what is the answer? How did it come to this?
Yes. So in other words, how did we get to the point where political history is no longer in fashion and is declining at our nation's universities? And I think there's to get an answer to that, we have to go all the way back to the Vietnam era, where the country is divided as a result of the war. And a lot of, as Americans sort of came to understand, there's what they call sort of a credibility gap. And there was this growing awareness that what our political leaders said was not often true. Mm-hmm. And this sort of, it created this sort of increasing cynicism. And that played out as well in our institutions of higher education, where the doings of presidents and political leaders sort of came to be viewed as a suspect enterprise, because they had been tarnished by the legacy of Vietnam and by some of the other ugly deeds that came to light, from the Cold War period. And so there was kind of a sort of, intellectual push from intellectuals in the 60s away from the so-called doings of great men. But even, I think, more importantly, is you had a demographic shift. So, partly as a result of the GI Bill sending lots of new people to college, you had a new generation of people coming through our colleges and eventually going on to PhDs that included, for the first time, women, peoples of color. And they began to sort of look at how the national story was being told as, a succession of white men doing, important deeds, and saying to themselves, well, where were the women? Where were people of color? What happens when we begin to add that to the story? And so you saw a very important change into acknowledging the very important role played by social movements, by minority groups, by the working class in particular. Mm-hmm. I think a favorite example of mine is Howard Zinn, who was one of the most influential historians of this time, mm-hmm. who wrote the best-selling People's History of the United States. He himself had served in the Second World War, had dropped bombs, napalm bombs during the war, but he came from a working class background. And when he went to pursue his education, he said, wait a minute, there's no workers out there. What happens when we start looking at the past from that perspective? So all that was important, but the pendulum swung so far, and it's never really swung back. And so we needed to change the story in the ways that those people did. But at the same time, now we're reaching a point where it becomes harder and harder for a serious scholar to do work on hardcore politics and get a job and teach at our nation's universities.
You remind us in your article, and this is amazing, in the last decade, just 16 new jobs were created in this field. 16!
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. We were astonished by that finding. We looked through the only place we can search the archive, which is this website known as HNET that lists political jobs, and you can go back that far. And we looked for jobs that specifically advertise an opening, we want a political historian. And that's an important way to think about it, because in many ways those decisions indicate priorities, right? So institutions have limited resources. They have to say, what are we going to invest in? And this is basically institutions voting and saying that other things are more important. And undoubtedly, there are lots of other important things out there, but it's an indication that political history is not perceived to be as valuable an enterprise as it should be. And more importantly, it means that anyone going through graduate school when thinking about becoming a college professor, if they have any sense about them, they won't pursue a PhD in this. They won't pursue the specialization, or they'll think very carefully about how they do so, because the risks of being unemployed are so great.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the letters to the editor that appeared just a couple days ago in response to your op-ed. One of them highlighted saying that this was a symptom of a larger problem. When did universities, he writes, stop requiring American history? Only 18% of colleges and universities require students to take a course in U.S. history or government. That's pathetic.
It is. There's a whole broader context here, and that broader context is super important. So you have a decline, as that letter writer notes, in institutions requiring U.S. history. You also have a broader context of humanities coming under attack or being increasingly viewed as suspect. So the kinds of context that's affecting history are also affecting literature and sociology and psychology right down the line. Of humanities and social sciences in favor of the sort of hardcore jobs, forms of skills and training that lead to jobs, so particularly in STEM education, what have you. And so you have this larger context as well. We could even go down into the elementary and secondary school systems with the push on standardized testing. I had this interesting experience. I taught at Florida Atlantic University for 10 years, and one of the things I did, on the occasional weekend, was I reached out and did history education training for history teachers in the Broward County School District. And many of them were really hungry for, you know, the kind of detailed information I could give them on a weekend seminar. But many of them also shared with me their frustration that they wouldn't really actually be able to put this knowledge into practice as much as they would like, because they're under so much pressure to meet the goals of standardized tests, and this isn't one of them. Right. And therefore, they basically were telling me, we have to kind of sneak it in where we can. And this reflects a larger set of priorities we're making as a country.
Yeah, it's amazing that we have a whole generation of people who just don't understand who walked this earth before them. And that's an important thing to know, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I my students, we always have these interesting conversations about why history matters. And the sort of rote answer you get is, you know, keep from making the same mistakes. And to some extent that's true, but then we'll often make different kinds of mistakes. So there are other types of values that come from historical education that I think are really important. And one of the most important is empathy. That right. When you study history and you study people from a different time, from a different place, in a different set of circumstances, the most important thing you have to do is try to understand them. And when you begin that process of trying to understand them, it awakens your mind to the possibility of understanding other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that, you know, you can't complete on a standardized test. You can't put it on your resume, right? But it's so important to leadership, to transformative change, to informed dialogue, to friendships, right? All of these things are so important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a key skill that comes out of the study of history that, to my mind, is often not recognized as being as important as it should be.
Mm-hmm. I've had the pleasure of being in Ireland several times, and I noticed in
Me
your
too,
resume,
actually.
I know that you taught at University College Dublin, and I always found the people to be so vitally interested in history and to know so much about American political history as well as European political history. Have you found a vast difference between the curriculum and the amount of interest when you compare European students, in this case Irish students, to American students?
Well, my year, I spent a year teaching at University College Dublin, and it was right when the Iraq War was getting underway. And the experience was amazing to me on several levels, one of which is something you're alluding to, in that I quickly discovered that my Irish students had a far more sophisticated grounding in American history than the American students I had been teaching for 10 years. When I began to talk about Woodrow Wilson, I couldn't continue with, basic information about him. They interrupted me with questions because they knew a lot about him. They thought about him. You wouldn't have that happen very often here, unfortunately. And the other interesting feature about it, of course, was that they sort of recognized, and one of the reasons why they paid such a close attention to America is that they're on the receiving end, like so many other countries around the world, of American power. And they understand the reach and impact of that power. And to my mind, that poses a challenge to us as American citizens, that if we're going to exert this great power around the world, we'd better understand what impact it's having, and we better understand the context from which that impact has emerged.
Kenneth Osgood, our guest, he's a professor of history and director of the McBride Honors Program in Public Affairs at Colorado School of Mines. He's the co-author of a piece, you may have seen it, that appeared in the New York Times, an op-ed piece on the endangered political historian. He has written a number of very interesting books. Remind me to ask him about, because this sounds fascinating. He's now writing a book about the connections between the ad industry and the CIA in the 1950s and 1960s. He's written a number of books, Total Cold War, Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda Battle at Home and Abroad, The Cold War After Stalin's Death, A Missed Opportunity for Peace. So we could take on this issue of political history and not finding a place for teaching it in universities, which means that there won't be very many professors who have expertise in this area, which means that won't translate to people who have expertise in high school instruction or in middle school instruction. But it's also part of a broader neglect of history because we have to get our test scores up in science and math, those fields, and so we're neglecting this huge, rich, important field. Only 18% of college people are taking a course in history? That's amazing. Plus, it's just phenomenally interesting, right? What better way to spend your time? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, and we start with Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Yes, Kathleen, you were amazed that there were only 16 openings for political historians, but isn't that, aren't you amazed because our political history, you know, has taken a 180-degree turn lately, but most of the time, I mean, for the last 50 years, it's been very boring. or the same.
Is it boring, Kenneth?
Oh, well, you know, it's a great question. I mean, so, you know, over the years, introducing myself to people and saying I'm a historian, I get one of two responses, and I only get one of the same two responses. It's either, oh, history, I love history, I had this great teacher, or, oh, history, it's so boring, it's not my thing. And so much about history is about presentation, and helping students relate to these times and events that are distant and strange to you. And even myself, having studied, you know, history all my life, there are times where I can't really wrap my head around something for a while. And then all of a sudden it clicks to me and I understand and I empathize with it. So I think that's the challenge. Politics doesn't have to be boring. And it can be if it's just a sort of recitation of mindless, mind-numbing detail, right? But the best history is taught by posing challenges and interpretive challenges. You know, mm-hmm. How did this come to pass? What does it mean? That's the question I always ask my students. So we've sorted out the facts. Now, what does it mean? That's where the challenge becomes. So I think as we think about even expanding our offerings in political history, we need to keep in mind about how to do this in a way that is engaging and relevant. You know, and actually I'm teaching an honors course in U.S. history here at Mines to my science and engineering students, where every week we're marching through an episode of the past, but we're looking at its contemporary relevance. So next week, for example, we're covering the New Deal, and we're looking at comparing it with the housing crash.
The
economic crisis of 2008. You know, we look at surveillance. We look at FBI surveillance during the Cold War, and then NSA surveillance, and Snowden in the current situation. And in that way, kind of see and sort of explore these linkages between things that seem so pressing in the present, but how they have these interesting and complex echoes in the past.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a search for the truth, isn't it? Because sometimes what we thought was historically true changes, or you have to read differing versions of what happened at a certain time to discern for yourself, as a very critical reader and somebody who's knowledgeable about history, where the truth is. That's interesting.
Yeah, and that quest for truth is really challenging, and that task of trying to seek the truth, I think, is one of the most important things that historians do. So I just actually had a fantastic class meeting last night where we discussed The Ludlow Massacre, which occurred in Colorado in 1914, where a group of striking workers were attacked by militia guards, technically National Guards troops, but actually employed by, being paid for by the mining companies. And you had several women and children buried alive, and it precipitated a sort of low-level warfare for several months thereafter. But the way we approached this lesson was we looked at original primary documents, one of them written by the soldiers who fired on the striking miners, and it sort of said, you know, here's all the set of circumstances, and everything was started by the crazy miners, especially the crazy Greeks. And then you have on the other side, you have the miners produce a pamphlet saying this was an innocent massacre, we were just playing baseball, and all of a sudden the Gatling guns started rolling over the tents. And the whole question was, okay, how do we find truth in these two very conflicting accounts?
Kenneth, thanks so much for your call. Philip in Elkhorn, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I told you a little while ago, I'm an AP teacher myself, AP U.S. History and AP Government. And naturally, I was piqued by this conversation. But one of the things that I've bumped into in my high school students when I'm teaching AP is they're not comfortable with ambiguity. And the idea that I think Einstein's favorite quote of mine is that everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And the idea that, especially in whatever history it is, you never really know what is right and what is wrong. It's a very complicated puzzle, and you may never have all the pieces completely. And instead of a regurgitation of facts and figures and things of that sort, they have to become comfortable with the process never ends and understanding why people do the things they do and how they react to certain things. I think that's the way history should be taught, is the concepts, the process, rather than just facts and figures.
Kenneth.
Yeah, let me just say, Philip, to quote a popular saying these days, thank you for your service. Sounds like you're a marvelous history teacher, doing well by your students. And, you know, I think you make a fantastic point about the value of understanding ambiguity. We often want to teach history as a morality play, but it really seldom is quite so clear-cut, and it's often very messy. And humans are very complex. They operate for lots of crazy reasons, and sometimes those reasons are evident, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're hidden and masked, and sometimes they're not honest with themselves. And so it sounds to me like framing your courses as a quest for finding truth in ambiguity, I think, is marvelous.
Yes, thank you so much for your call. Carry on, Philip. Sue writes on Facebook, do political science students study a lot of history? Do they take a lot of history courses?
Well, I shouldn't speak too authoritatively to the field of political science. I sort of, you know, play with political scientists on weekends, but I don't have I don't have an intimate knowledge of how things take place in a lot of political science majors. I do know that the field of political science itself has changed in the past several decades as well, and one of the emphasis we see increasingly is on theory and on quantifying theories. And so some political science classes look like calculus classes, and that has certain benefits to it, but it also suggests that there still needs to be a place for the role of historians with their quest for ambiguity and complexity to participate in the conversation about the role of politics in our country.
We go to Todd in Appleton. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
Hi.
The reason I call is I'm retired from the military, and my hobby has always been history. And in college, I majored in something else, but I took history classes, and I really like American history. I just can't understand with the democracy that we have, which is a government of participation, and as the previous caller said, it's a process that, you know, how can we make intelligent choices at election time and in our government? Such as it is, not knowing where we've come from. And that really bothers me. It's becoming acute now.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Todd, and thank you, too, for your service and for keeping up the good hobby of studying history. My dad was also retired military and someone who loved history as a hobby, and so I think I got a lot of my inspiration from him. Your comment about needing to make intelligent, informed choices is critical. In fact, if you really want to understand the partisan divide we're in now, you have to understand this context from where we're coming. We are still, in some ways, living with a political culture that is fighting the battles that are reminiscent of the 1960s. The cultural and social transformations that took place in that form a lot of the backdrop to some of the conversations we're having today about race and gender, about culture, and have actually influenced our partisan divide quite significantly.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? You mentioned the Vietnam War opening up the academic community to those who had not been a part of it, women, minorities, and how that both added to a curriculum of political history and where it may have caused some problems. I'm interested in that.
Yeah, so I think where we had it initially was there was an important corrective going on, and that if you look at the history that was taught in the 40s and 50s, in many ways there was a heavy tinge of nationalist propaganda and patriotic propaganda. Actually, one of the posts, our op-ed got some almost 500 comments on the New York Times webpage. Actually, they eventually shut it down, I'm told.
Really?
Which was terrific for us. I mean, just delighted to see how many people, a lot of them teachers, like the previous caller, weighing in. But one commenter wrote in, "Our history was a terrific subject when it was propaganda. I was taught that Buffalo Bill was this great buffalo hunter. This was his story in our history books. A few years ago, I found out his mission was to wipe out the buffalo, to starve Native Americans to death." And then he sort of continues, you know, "We loved history when it was propaganda of the white ruling class. Mm-hmm. We turned away when it's not pleasant." And there's some element of truth in that. If you look at the story that was told in the 1950s, it was really a march of progress. We've overcome all these great difficulties. We're the shining beacon of democracy. In fact, even the president of the American Historical Association, I think it was in 1958, gives a speech to all the historians in the country and basically says, you know, we're at war with communism, and everyone has to do his or her, his part. Actually, it would have been the discourse of the 50s.
Right.
And that means we have to teach the blessings of liberty and how our country has stood up against that. And so you have this moment where, you know, American history is just the story of greatness. And then you have Vietnam set in. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty hard to swallow that story. And you have the civil rights movement, and it's pretty hard to sort of accept that this is a story of greatness when kids are being attacked by dogs and fire hoses. And so people begin to ask much more critical questions, and they begin to find, you know, a lot of the ugliness in American past. And so then you have this sweep where we're finding, you know, all kinds of we're actually not finding, we're bringing to light so much that has been ignored in this rush to valorize our story. You know, fast forward a few years, and into the 90s, those rough political edges from the Vietnam era begin to soften. So we're not still sort of fighting some of those same, ideologically charged interpretations. But you still sort of a lingering effect. And what we do see, and this is sort of the good news in a lot of this, and it's something that we couldn't talk about in the op-ed due to the limitations of space, but that although political history has suffered this decline, there has been this encouraging sort of uptick in the past, you know, five some odd years, where we've seen a lot of really interesting scholarship exploring the connection, say, between politics and culture and between politics and social movements. That's a lot of really great writing on the conservative movement and how that has been affected by changes at the grassroots. Right. And so in that sense, we're looking at the intersection between sort of high politics and grassroots movements, eminently important. If you need proof, look at the current election.
Exactly. Thanks, Todd, so much for your call. Dick in Grafton, hi.
Hi. First, I just want to mention first, and then tell. I am now a senior, therefore I have more time to read history.
Excellent.
But I had to take one extra course in U.S. history when I was in college, and so I took a Revolutionary War, and it was taught to by a professor who had been in had his education in England. And he taught it from the English viewpoint.
Hmm.
Mm.
And there were a few dates that matched, but I didn't know it was the same war. But then his tests, and you've had this comment a couple times, were not memorizing dates and battles and everything. It was period-oriented to, and it's, I was going to school back in the 60s, or in the 50s, I'm sorry. But it was period-oriented in that time, and, hey, what is, why are we doing this because of that type, our society? And one of the things I'll just add now, that I do not believe, when you say they're not having history, I'm shocked because how we as a nation can understand what is happening in the world without having a background in history. Because, you know, the Middle East, that's what's going on there. Well, you know, it's not just in the last 30 years. It goes back a long ways. And that's all the history that people should know. So that's all I have to say. It sounds, your program that I've heard about part of it is excellent. I thank you very much. I just had to make this comment.
Thank you, Dick.
Thanks a lot, Dick. If you're still on the line, what did you mean by your history? Is he still there?
Dick, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, good, he's there.
Oh, I was going to ask you, so what did you mean when you said that your history course was period-oriented?
Well, the tests were the Revolutionary War, and he was talking about his tests were not just reiterating battles and stuff like that. It was sort of a social-type history as far as, hey, this is what happened during this period that we're covering. And now when we're there, you're in the 50s, and could you relate how this sort of carries through back and forth? And it was sort of they were very, you know, you sat down and wrote, right, you had to think about it. History, just memorizing a bunch of dates, I limited value in my estimation.
I completely agree.
Try to get an application. And that's what I think today, this is everybody is so busy about. Well, I won't get into politics, but I wish they'd just get there, see what happened in the past, and see if they'd carry through some of this stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
So
your point about sort of memorizing dates and things of that nature, right? And I'm sort of mindful of as Fred and I made this critique, and we call for more political history, and there's a certain slight risk in what we're saying, in the sense that you can imagine someone saying, "Well, we need to now have standardized tests in American history; everyone has to take," and you can imagine how easily politicized that would be. What do we think matters? What sort of information should we cram down students' heads? And to my mind, the value of history is not sort of having this compendium of useless or maybe useful trivia or information you can spout off at dinner parties, but it's about developing that ability to see things with greater complexity and, as the previous caller said, greater ambiguity. And it sounds to me like the way his Dick's Revolutionary War class was taught from the English perspective is a great example of how teaching a familiar subject but through a different lens mm-hmm. can open up a whole new perspective and a whole different way of sort of understanding our place in the world. And it actually brings to mind, I think, another important sort of caveat to our argument that I should make, that one of the other sort of reasons that, you know, U.S. political history, or even in some ways U.S. history, has sort of declined in some ways, is an awareness that we need to also study and that Americans really need to understand the global context in which they live. And so there's been an emphasis on placing the American story in its larger context to kind of get us away from this idea that we're somehow exceptional, unique, and totally unprecedented in the history of the world. And in fact, there are lots of other ways that other people are like Americans and unlike Americans, and it's a messy situation. So this framing in the global and international context is a really important development that can change the way we understand the American experience. But at the same time, we still need to understand the American experience.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor Osgood, just to get a better idea of if you were majoring in political history, over the course of a year, you would be studying what? How would you be arranging the courses that someone would take?
Well, most history programs are, you know, kind of have a buffet-like approach. You know, there'll be some set of requirements. So usually they're geographically and sort of chronologically organized. So it will change from college to college, but you might have a requirement that you need to take one course from, you know, at least one course in U.S. history, at least one course in Europe, and at least one course in Latin America or something like that. And then, you know, at least one modern and one pre-modern. So usually there's some form of emphasis, and there is not often a capacity for detailed specialization as an undergraduate. So you wouldn't be able to, in most places or any place that I know of, major in political history. You would be able to major in history. Our concern is that at many universities, you wouldn't even have the capacity to study political history. You might get exposure to some political topics in the context of other topics, but if you really wanted to go in depth on political history, at many universities, you would not have that option.
Kenneth Osgood, our guest, professor of history and director of the Honors Program in Public Affairs at Colorado School of Mines. He's written a number of very interesting books and is co-author of a New York Times op-ed piece that appeared late in August that caught our attention, that looked at the decline in the study of political history in our universities and how that is problematic. Mike in St. Lawrence. Hello.
Hey.
Hi, Mike.
Kathleen, how you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Okay, good.
Good.
My comment is, Mrs. Engstrom, bless her heart, when I was in the 11th grade, it was just route memorization. That's all history was. The War of 1812, the Revolutionary War, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I flunked the course, of course.
Oh, no.
Anyway, but my point was that I think that civics and history and politics should be begun some kind of curriculum from first grade on, all the way up to 12th grade. So when people graduate, when kids graduate at 17 years old or 18, they know about their local politics. Who's actually on the committee? Who's on Washington County Board? Who's on state politics? Who's this guy? Who's that guy? Who's this? Who's that? I don't see that in any kind of curriculum. And I've talked with my friends up north when I go deer hunting and drink a lot of beer, and I say, this should be done. I mean, this is civics. This is what this
right.
country's about, and it's not being taught. And you get kids coming out of grade 12, and they don't even know who their county commissioner is.
Right.
Or who, you know. So anyway, that's my comment. So.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, for
yeah.
the call. Ken.
Yeah, I completely agree, Mike. I mean, we definitely need to help our citizens understand that there is government all around them, and what does it do, and how does it function, and what is their capacity for getting involved in influencing things. Boy, that sure would make a lot of difference if people understood that. Before we go on to the next caller, I just wanted to make
sure.
a quick general comment. I'm noticing a lot of lovers of history calling in, and I would be remiss if I didn't, you've been generous to plug my own work, but I would be remiss if I didn't call out my co-author, Fred Logoval, who very deservedly won the Pulitzer Prize for Embers of War, a brilliant account of the origins of the Vietnam War.
Oh.
So if your listeners are looking for something to read, there's another one to add to their list.
That's very generous of you, Kenneth. And I want to hear just briefly, because I find this fascinating, about the connections between the advertising industry and the CIA in the 50s and the 60s. Are you writing that book now?
I am. It's a labor of love, proceeding at a snail's pace. But, the entree to the story is really interesting. Actually, some of your listeners may remember this, that in the 50s and 60s there was a very long-standing annual advertising campaign called the Crusade for Freedom that eventually became known as the Radio Free Europe Fund. And basically these messages would say, we need to bring truth to the people behind the Iron Curtain,
sure.
and you can play a part by donating a dollar to support Radio Free Europe. Well, as it turns out, that those advertisements and all that campaign was run by the CIA in cooperation with the advertising industry. And it was designed to serve kind of two functions. One was to provide a cover story for Radio Free Europe, which was actually a CIA front. And so they actually presented it to be like NPR, like it's funded from listeners like you by these $1 contributions, when in fact, you know, its $30 million budget was funded covertly by the agency. And then its other function, and it's actually quite explicit in the declassified documents that are now available, its other function was really, and its more important function really, was to try to sell the Cold War to the American people. And there was this recurring sense that Americans didn't understand the dangers of communism, didn't understand the threat to freedom that it proposes, and therefore we have to, in fact, inculcate them against the insidious effects of communist propaganda. And oddly enough, we do that through our own propaganda.
That's fascinating. It'll be a good book. Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. We go to Ron in La Crosse. Hello, Ron.
Yes, I'm learning a lot more about political history and other history of our country on these public television documentaries. And I know that Stanley Carno had his public TV documentary on Vietnam, and Ken Burns is now making one on Vietnam War. And I just wonder, maybe it's in the Pentagon Papers, but towards the end of Kennedy's serving in office, before he was assassinated, even though he increased the number of military advisors in Vietnam, he actually did an about this a week or so before he was murdered. And I guess it was a national security directive, and I don't remember the number of the directive, but he's stating that not only were we not going to send any more advisors or CIA personnel to South Vietnam, we were going to start withdrawing them, and that all Americans, whether they're military or CIA, would be out of Vietnam by 1965. Well, that's half of it. And then he was assassinated. Johnson becomes the 36th president, and he issued his own national security directive. I don't know exactly what they call it, and saying that the previous national security directive issued by President Kennedy was rescinded, was repealed. And I've only heard about this once, and I was just wondering if maybe your guest knew about it. Maybe it'll be in Ken Burns' documentary. Maybe it's in the Pentagon Papers. I don't know.
Kenneth.
So, Ron, great questions. And there is sort of a longstanding debate. And actually, this is something my co-author has also written about. And I remember him posing the question to me as, you know, what if Lee Harvey Oswald was a lesser marksman? Would we have gotten into Vietnam? And there certainly is evidence to indicate that Kennedy was considering a different approach. And Kennedy would have been in a different situation than Johnson found himself in the sense that come 1964, he would have been an incumbent. So he would have been freed a little bit from some of the domestic political baggage that would frame Johnson's reaction to the war. Of course, we can't know for sure. We do know that it was under consideration, as the caller indicated. But what ultimately Kennedy would have done would have evolved, I think, according to circumstance, how he read the political winds, how he read his own opportunities. But a fascinating and really interesting question.
Have you read the Larry Tye biography of Bobby Kennedy, Kenneth?
I haven't. I read his book on Edward Bernays is one of my favorites and influenced my own writing on propaganda history, but I haven't read his Bobby
Kennedy. Yeah, it's really good, and it looks at, you may be interested in reading it as well, Ron, because it covers a little bit of that, but it's one of those pieces, talk about it, pieces of historical accuracy, because he talks to so many people and there are so many points of view that you get a complete picture of the nuances, the things that, you know, he probably wouldn't have been proud of in his life and the things that he would have been proud of and how he transformed. And it's just really good. It's a good, good piece of history, I think.
Excellent.
Yeah. Highly recommended. Ron, thanks so much for your call. John, it's almost time. We're almost finished. How could that happen? John in Milwaukee. Hi.
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 Could I ask your guest if he heard of the book Imperial Cruise about Teddy Roosevelt's imperialistic cruise in 1904-05 to China and Japan?
I have. And what about it fascinates you?
Yeah, maybe when I get off the air, you would comment on that. I was thinking, what do you think of YouTube as a presenter of alternative histories? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, John, thanks.
Sure. Well, I'm not sure I could go into great depth about the Imperial Cruise, but I'll comment a little bit on YouTube just as a really neat asset for those of us who are in the trenches teaching history. And one of the great things about it is you have at your fingertips all these great primary sources now.
Yes.
And you can actually pull up, you know, especially teaching modern history, you can pull up press conferences or important political speeches. You can help bring students into that universe. And you can use it as a tool also for understanding how is language used and made. You know, so we can, rather than just reading the text of Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, for example, we can watch it, we can listen to the intonation, and we can talk about it in sort of a deeper way. What impact is he having? How is he using that language? What are his choices he's making? So, I mean, I just love using YouTube in my own teaching.
Yeah, we love it, too, to find clips of history. They're just fascinating. It's good to see things. Well, this hour just went by in a darn
hurry. Sure did.
Yeah. Kenneth, thank you so much for being with us. Let us know when the book comes out, please.
I will. Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks. We'll call you again. Hope you'll say yes. You'll be on the air again. Kenneth Osgood, professor of history, director of the McBride Honors Program in Public Affairs at Colorado School of Mines. He's written a lot of books on Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda Battle at Home and Abroad, which won the Herbert Hoover Book Award for Best Book on Any Aspect of U.S. History during the whole 20th century. And he's written other books. His recent piece, co-authored in the New York Times, Why Did We Stop Teaching Political History? Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. During this hour on Monday, an incredible organization called Purple Hearts Reunited.